Before you head out to the pumpkin patch, stop and listen. This hour, we'll learn about the squash family and find out how to pick the perfect jack-o'-lantern. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. They're easy to grow, decorative, and delicious. This is the season for pumpkins, squashes, and gourds. Aaron Style of Ryman Gardens and Linda Knave of Iowa State University Extension will be here today. We'll get pumpkin picking advice, find out why this was such a good year for pumpkins, and even dig into the history of the jack-o'-lantern. Also, Aaron and Linda will answer your questions. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. The leaves are beautiful, the air is cool, and pumpkins are appearing on porches everywhere. This hour, we're going to talk about pumpkins and other members of the squash family. With me today, Aaron Style, who's manager of public programs at Ryman Gardens. Hello, Aaron.
Hello.
And Linda Knave, Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist in the Extension Value Added Agriculture Program. Hello, Linda.
Good morning, Charity. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you both for being here today. And it was a very good year for pumpkins this year, wasn't it, Linda?
It was, Charity. And are you ready for a quiz again today?
Oh, my goodness.
No, I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, suddenly you're not invited back ever again.
But you did so well on the first one. It was a very good year for pumpkins this year. And you'll find there are the pumpkin growers around the state have an ample supply of beautiful pumpkins out in the field. And one of the reasons is just the weather. We had pretty good weather, and we didn't have many insect pests early in the season, which tend to feed on the pumpkins and the squash early in the season on the vines and create a lot of problems. So with a minimal insect infestation early, the pumpkins had a great chance to grow and fruit and set on before the pests really became any kind of a problem. So I think that has to do with it. We had ample rains. It wasn't a drought. Actually, it was a really good year.
And so if it was a good year for pumpkins, was it also a very good year for other members of the squash family?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. Cucumber, squash, zucchini, other types of summer squash. It was a very good year.
Excellent.
We had some good pollinator activity, I think, too, out there. So, and if we wouldn't have our pumpkins and our squash without pollinators. So those pumpkin growers who are out there really appreciate the bees, the butterflies, and other native pollinators that are there to help them along.
And this is a family that tends to be very easy to grow. Is that a true assumption? I mean, people are trying to give away their cucumbers and their zucchini.
You know, that's true. I think, you know, often I think we both hesitated because mm-hmm. there are some really serious insect pests with this group of plants, in particular squash vine mm-hmm. borer, which can be really hard to deal with. But if you can get around those things, yeah, I mean, usually you have no problem having enough zucchini.
If they grow, they produce well, pretty much. Yeah, they do well. And again, if you have some pollinators in the area to get the flowers pollinated, fruit set on, you do have a pretty good year, yes.
Now, of course, when you go to the Iowa State Fair or any of the county fairs, you see those giant pumpkins mm-hmm. that people grow. How do people do that? I understand how to grow a nice 10 to 15 pound pumpkin. How do you grow a 300 pound pumpkin?
Well, one of the most important thing is genetics. You have to have a variety that will grow big and very big. And with that, you find that variety and you can find that information through various associations, the World Pumpkin Federation, which is actually housed here in Iowa. And it's pretty cool. Up in Anamosa, they have a way off Pumpkin Confederation way off. That's fun to go to. But anyway, so you start with genetics, and then it's a science. It's a science in how far apart you plant those, the amount of fertilizer, water, and pruning you do to get those one or two pumpkins only sitting on that vine. Then you pamper them, make sure the vine is not crimped, as that pumpkin starts to grow, maybe shade it. There are lots of tricks to the trade.
So everybody's got their own, I'm sure.
It's like raising a pet during the summertime. It really is.
We were, my kids and I are reading all the Little House books, and we read Farmer Boy, and he has a milk-fed pumpkin where he creates a little slit in the vine, and then milk is wicked up into the vine that's supposed to make his pumpkin large. And he does win at the county fair. So, but pumpkins can't really drink milk, can they?
No. And that's not probably the way you would do that. You would probably create more harm to the plant than you would benefit.
It sounded risky to me, but yes, it's hard to argue with Farmer Boy. So of course, this time of year, pumpkins are a huge attraction for a lot of people. We go out, we pick them in pick your own farms, or we go to pumpkin patches. We want them on our porch. When you go to pick a pumpkin, how do you pick a good one?
Well, I think the important part is to find one that doesn't have any bruises, scratches, blemishes on it, because those are the spots where you get decay-causing organisms that will shorten the life of your pumpkin. So obviously you want to get one that's nice and uniform in color and the right size and a good shape and all that, but you want to make sure that it doesn't have a lot of scratches and blemishes on it. That'll go a long way. And, you know, cleaning that pumpkin off when you get it home, not carrying it around by the stem, which makes a terrible handle, very easily broken off. And the pumpkin actually lasts longer if the stem's on it. So you want to try to protect that. And then making sure if you can cure the pumpkin, that goes a long way.
How do you cure a pumpkin?
Well, you know, for the average homeowner, this is actually a little hard to do. But ideally, you would, for about a week or so, maybe 10 days, 80 degrees, 80% humidity. And then once it's done with that curing process, you'll want to store it in a much cooler, drier location. So 55 degrees and dry. And you don't want to pile your pumpkins up. That can cause some problems. You want to remove any that may show signs of getting soft or decay, because, you know, one bad pumpkin spoils the whole batch. That adage is true. You also want to avoid storing it with things like apples or onions, because those can help hasten decay in some of those, especially smaller gourds and stuff.
Now, pumpkins, of course, are a wonderful source for food, but mm-hmm. so many people buy them purely for decorative purposes.
Yeah.
I can imagine that might be a little bit frustrating as a pumpkin grower to think that you've grown all of this wonderful food, but nobody's going to eat it except maybe squirrels.
Well, most of the pumpkins we grow really are for ornamental purposes. I mean, the little sugar pie pumpkins are used for baking, but a jack-o'-lantern type pumpkin is actually a terrible mm-hmm. source of food. So in that sense, it isn't frustrating. And in fact, one little interesting fact about pumpkin is that the canned pumpkin pie filling, or the canned pumpkin that you buy, is typically not pumpkin. It's usually butternut squash, which is a very close relative.
Mm-hmm. But squash pie just doesn't have the right ring.
No, not at all.
Yeah, the jack-o'-lanterns have been bred for jack-o'-lanterns, mm-hmm. not for edible consistency. As Aaron mentioned, the sugar pie pumpkins are excellent for that. It just takes a while, and we're in this instant gratification society that we want something processed already for us. You can get a sugar pie pumpkin, cut it in half, scoop it out, put it on a baking sheet and bake it, and then scoop out the pulp and turn it into, puree it and turn it into pumpkin. But not many people are willing to go to that trouble.
Yeah.
I've done it. It's fun.
Once.
It takes a lot of once.
It's fun
maybe
once.
Maybe twice, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's nice to have somebody do it for you. And canned pumpkin is good, and it's very nutritious as well.
So when we talk about seeds of different plants, of course, some people eat pumpkin seeds. There are lots and lots of ways to use pumpkin seeds. But if you choose to save your pumpkin seeds, if you have a jack-o'-lantern pumpkin that you particularly like and you think, hey, I want to grow that in my garden next year, can you do that too?
You could, but I wouldn't.
Okay.
Many of the seeds we have today are hybrid seeds. And let's say this is when I was first starting in horticulture, we battled this question a lot. And old wives' tale, so to speak, where you can't plant your pumpkins next to your squash, next to your watermelons, or they'll cross-pollinate. There's nothing to that. They will cross-pollinate, but it won't affect this year's crop. So if you do get a cross of some kind, and you, let's say you're growing a delicata squash next to an acorn squash, you'll still get a delicata squash and an acorn squash. But if you save the seed out of that acorn squash, it will look funny and have some characteristics perhaps in the delicata due to some cross-pollination. So you could try it. There's nothing wrong. And sometimes if you let a pumpkin or a squash rot out in your garden over the winter, you'll get a volunteer coming up. And I've had a lot of young people say, oh, you know, we got a squash come up in our garden. We don't know what kind it is. What kind is it? Well, wait and see.
Yeah.
You'll find
it
might be something totally strange.
And you
something
just
you've
invented
never planted.
A new
yes,
hybrid, right?
Exactly. So do we say it's a bad thing? No, it's just be prepared that you might not get exactly what you think you're going to have.
Now, you mentioned that most of the pumpkins that we grow are for decorative purposes. Aaron, do you know how long this goes back? How long we've been growing pumpkins just for decoration?
Well, I think, you know, the many of the, especially Irish and Scottish immigrants that came to this country, especially around the turn of the, what would be the 20th century, were bringing across traditions of jack-o'-lanterns, but they weren't using pumpkins. They were using other things like turnips and beets and potatoes. Pumpkins are North American natives, and they actually work very well for jack-o'-lanterns because of their hard outer shell, and they're easy to scoop out, and because they were so easy to come by here in North America, they kind of turned into this tradition that really is kind of a North American tradition because of it being native here. And so, I mean, at least 100 years people have been doing this here. And especially in the especially in the 1950s is when it really started to become a family activity, part of kind of the American family culture, I guess you could say.
Well, and I see a lot of people get really excited about creating their jack-o'-lanterns and doing mm-hmm. it pretty early in October. And then by the time Halloween rolls around, they're pretty mushy.
They're pretty mushy.
How long should a pumpkin last and look pretty decent after you carve it?
After you carve it? Boy, yeah. A week would be great if you could do that.
It depends on the weather.
It does depend a lot on the weather. If the weather is cool but not freezing, if it's dry, it could last a little bit longer than if it were warmer or wet, or if you have a lot of really awful, nasty neighborhood kids.
Or squirrels.
Right.
You know, like all businesses, the pumpkin industry has changed over the years, too. And in recent years, we're seeing a lot more white pumpkins on the market. A lot of new varieties.
Right.
The ghost pumpkins. Spooky is a variety of pumpkin that we're seeing a lot of from all sizes, from the little miniatures all the way up to really beautiful ones. Those take a little more skill to grow than the orange pumpkins, I think, because you have to set them upright. You don't want any kind of blemish on them because it does affect that beautiful white color. And if you store them in light, they yellow a little bit. So they're a little trickier, but they're fun because they've got an orange flesh.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. We've been talking about pumpkins so far this hour, but of course, we will take your questions about any of the plants in your life. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Aaron Stile, Manager of Public Programs at Ryman Gardens, and Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist in the Value Added Agriculture Program. And Linda, you were just talking about some of those little novelty pumpkins, the white ones and things that are selling well these days for decorative purposes. Does that mean there are a lot of people working hard to create even more interesting pumpkin hybrids for the next 10 years of novelty crops?
I think there are. There's always going to be something going out there, and the white pumpkin is the latest, or one of the latest. One of the things the breeders, too, are looking at is insect and disease resistance, and that's important, too. It's important to the growers. You know, those of us consumers just assume all that happens, but it's behind the scenes, so.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Here's an email from Meredith. She says, every year, squash bugs are the biggest challenge I face in my garden, and they usually win. I've tried picking off the bugs and their eggs and spraying organic insecticide, but to no avail. How do you defeat them?
We're both looking at each other. Okay. They are a tough one. The key is to, as she said, to get on it early. The squash bug has what we define as an incomplete life cycle, meaning they lay their egg, the adults emerge, they lay their eggs, and the eggs hatch into little squash bugs that are little gray, dark and little gray, and then they turn into a little bigger light gray bug, and then eventually the hard-shelled black squash bug that we see. The best time to control them is when they just hatch out of their eggs, because they are the most vulnerable. Your particular email listener says she uses organic insecticide, and some products do work okay. Insecticidal soap is not really effective on squash bugs. Pyganic and some of the neem insecticides are fairly good. Many are either growth development interrupters, or they're on contact insecticide, where many of the non-organic are residual insecticides. They'll last a little longer. So squash bugs are a real problem. What they do is they feed on the sap of the plants, and they take the vigor out of the plants. The plants kind of turn a little crispy and eventually die off prematurely before maybe the fruits mature and set on.
And if you've had problems with squash bugs in the past, does that mean that you're more likely to have problems in the future? Are they living in the soil and coming back next year?
Yes, they're pretty much a thing you can expect every year to come back.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to the phones. Marlis is on the line in Cedar Rapids at 866-780-9100. Hi, Marlis.
Hi there. We moved from a house to a condo, and I potted up a few hostas, not very many. But I know I can't leave them out on our condo patio in the pots, and now we don't have outbuildings or other places to store them. How can I winter them over in the pots? And do I cut them off first, or?
I think the best strategy for you here is to overwinter them in the pot, but to dig or heel that pot into the ground. It'll be really important to protect the root system of that plant. And when it's in a container above the ground, it just gets too cold.
But do you have a lawn where you can do that, Marlis?
Yeah.
No, I do not.
Oh.
We have a garage, but it's an attached garage, so it isn't terribly cold out there. It's not heated, but it's...
Ideally,
would that be okay?
Yeah, I mean, that would be better, I suppose. Ideally, you want it to get cool so that plant can kind of go through its life cycle. Often... One of the challenges with overwintering, say, in our garage is forgetting to water the thing. So you want to make sure that you're careful not to let the plant completely dry out if you do overwinter it in your garage. Where is your final resting place for these plants?
I think they have to be in the pots.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this will be a big task for you year after year. I mean, hostas are a hardy plant, but... certainly, you know, the other option is if you had a very large container and a plant hardy enough like hosta, you may be able to overwinter them in that. But I'm talking very large, like the kinds that you see outside of big buildings and corporate offices. You could overwinter them in the garage. It's worth a try, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Right.
But make sure that you don't let it dry out. That will probably be the most challenging part.
Are these hostas that have a special meaning to you, Marlis?
Well, yeah, there's some good varieties there, and there were literally hundreds of hostas.
You had quite the collection at the house.
Yeah.
Some sentimental value then. I would go ahead and, as Aaron said, try them in the garage. Just don't forget to water them now and then. You might even want to put something around them to insulate the roots. But
okay.
You know,
I'll give it a try.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good luck, Marlis.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Bye-bye.
You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have room on the lines for your question right now, 866-780-9100. Here's an email from David in Des Moines. A yellow pear tomato plant sprouted in our yard this year. It grew like something out of a science fiction movie. And produce fruit prodigiously. Might seeds from that plant produce similar results next year? And how should one harvest seeds to try to make that happen again?
Well, chances are, if it was a yellow pear are not hybrids. They're old-fashioned, what some would term heirloom-type tomato. And so if they were out there growing, chances are they'll be fairly true to type. And to save the seed, the best thing to do is harvest that fruit when it's fully ripe, if not overripe, and just let it die back. I mean, rot almost. And then you would extract the seeds from that fruit, let it dry and dry very thoroughly, and get the pulp around off of, from around the fruit. Sometimes you see a tomato that has the seed sprouted inside late in the season. But typically, it won't. They won't sprout in that fruit. So you want that fruit to rot. Even if you let it rot outside in the garden and then scoop up some of those rotted seeds, they should be fine and bring them in. But just harvest a few few ripe fruits and extract the seeds from that.
All right.
Any comments on that, Aaron? Any other suggestions?
I think that's probably, I mean, tomato seeds are fairly easy to save from year to year. Obviously, we all get volunteers in the garden.
Yeah.
So I think the biggest thing will be making sure that you don't, that you let the tomato decay, but not get a whole bunch of mold and stuff
right,
all over it.
Right. And then once you get it dried, the seeds dried, thoroughly dried, store them in a cool, dry location. Maybe wrap them in paper towels, put them in a Ziploc bag, and store them in a dry, cool location. Even your basement would be fine, but it's the dryness that we want to maintain, while, because the seed is still a living organism. And once they imbibe a little water, they start to grow, and you could easily kill the seed by letting it get too moist or even mold or rot.
And so this volunteer grew in an unusual way. Do you think that there's a chance he can recreate that, or was that just serendipity?
I have a feeling it was just a good hardy plant. You know, some tomatoes are just more vigorous than others. It's part of their genetics. Mm-hmm. So obviously this was a very vigorous plant.
And the yellow pears are.
Yeah.
They're an indeterminate variety which grow and grow and grow.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there's a good chance that, that there'll be something really good to come out of those seeds next year too.
Oh, I think it's worth a shot for sure.
Oh, I do.
All right. All right. Let's go back to the phones. 866-780-9100. Travis is on the line from Humboldt. Hi, Travis.
Yes.
What's your question?
I traveled down into Oklahoma to visit relatives, and they had a Hong Kong orchid tree in their yard. And I'm not sure. It's right on the edge for temperate, if it could survive here or flourish in Iowa.
Probably not.
Both of us are shaking our heads.
No,
I think so.
Most of Oklahoma is like a zone 8. And we're a zone 5 here. That's a much warmer climate down there.
All right.
So sorry about that, Travis. We do see some beautiful things when we travel that will not make it in Iowa.
You know what's interesting about that, though, is, you know, a lot of us get really envious of all the great things you can grow in warmer climates. But you forget that people in warmer climates can't grow some of the things we grow here. Tulips, apples, some of those other things, too. So
absolutely. Well, and no one has our soil.
That's true.
That was when I moved to Michigan and planted my first garden. I was the first time I stuck a shovel into the ground. I thought, what? What is this? So we do get very, very spoiled with our Iowa soil. All right. Sean is on the line next in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Hi. Well, my dad lovingly started me 3 canes of Concord grapes earlier this spring in preparation for my family moving to a acreage near Cedar Rapids. And when we moved in, we put in some trellises and planted the Concord canes, 3 of them. They were all nice and bushy and long. And probably when we took them out of the ground at my dad's house, they must have been 12 feet, you know, of vines. put them in the ground here, tied them up to the trellises, and then they just gave up. We watered them, we fertilized them, but by the end of August, they were just brown and nothing. I'm wondering whether I should take them out, start over, let them winter. What should I do?
Well, I have a question for you. When you dug those vines, did you prune them back significantly, back down to, you know, just a few feet, a foot or two above the ground? Or did you try
No, we took them out full length and just put them back in the ground at the new place.
Yeah, that's probably a big part of the reason why they didn't turn out well. If they're brown and crispy now, they'll be brown and crispy next spring. So that's unfortunately probably what happened. But most of these grapes, they need to be pruned back pretty severely every year to have good harvest. And especially when you transplant them, you're removing the plant from the ground. It loses a lot of its roots, even if you take a good-sized root ball. And pruning back the vine will allow the plant to do a better job of supporting what's left, because you had a lot of top growth that there wasn't a lot of roots left to support. And that stress is probably what put the plant under.
What time of year did you make these? Did you dig them?
We dug them out like on August 1st, and by August 15th, they were toast.
Yeah, yeah, and that was a really stressful time of year,
right,
too.
The best time, if he has more you can dig, or if you can find some that you like, but it's nice to get it from your dad. It's a good memory. Mm. But I would do it in the spring, long before, maybe even in February if you can get into the soil. February, March, April, before it starts to leaf out, prune it back, and then dig the plant.
With as much
root ball as you can get.
All right, Sean, thanks a lot for your call. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Linda Nave from Iowa State University Extension and Aaron Stile from Ryman Gardens in Ames. And you can join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've been talking about squash bugs quite a lot this hour. And this is from Jill. She says, I've had good luck avoiding those darn squash bugs by using Elliot Coleman's suggestion of planting zucchini every couple of weeks throughout the season. As the bugs arrive on one plant, just pull it rather than dealing with the bugs, knowing new plants are on the way. Is that an approach that either one of you has used or seen used?
No, but I find a good way for insect control is one that many of the growers are using, and that it's a mechanical control, a barrier in which we put a row cover over the top of our plants early in the season and keep it over the plants until we start to see flowers. Once flowers happen, you've got to open it up for your pollinators. But what that does is it allows the plants to grow and become established before the cucumber beetles and the squash bugs find it. And they start setting fruit. And then if they come, it's not as serious. You did get a good crop off of it. Same thing with cucumbers. It keeps the cucumber beetles off.
Helps a lot with squash vine borer,
too. And squash vine borer, because squash vine borer is very predictable. Squash vine borer is that little white worm that bores into the stem just above the soil line. And they're very predictable. Sometime they fly between June 1st and June 10th in Iowa, depending on where you live, north or south in the state. But they're very predictable. And it's that one generation a year that comes on, that's the generation you've got to control. But the others, they come on kind of, sometimes you see them earlier and sometimes later.
So, and by a row cover, are you talking about a fine mesh or what kind of cover?
Yes, it's a spun bonded polyester, and it comes under the trade name Agrabon, and it comes under various shade or thicknesses, so it allows for various levels of light transmission. It does protect the plant somewhat against frost, and that's what it was originally designed for, is for frost protection early in the season. But we find it does a good job of keeping the insects out and does let the light through, and the moisture can get through it. So,
all right.
It's a good alternative to some of the other things. But as far as not ripping the plant off, how are you going to keep the bugs from moving down the row to the other plant?
Mm-hmm. All right, let's.
You agree, Aaron?
Yeah, it's kind of like a modified trap crop, but some growers will grow a certain type that they know the bugs like better, and then they don't plan to harvest that, and they plant it around the thing that they really want. So this seems like a modification of that, but it just seems like you'd always be tearing out zucchini.
Mm-hmm. I found this year at our farm, we found that Turk's turban squash seems to be, certain squashes really are magnets to the insects. They like it. Does that mean they stay away from the others? Well, they prefer that, but that doesn't mean they're their only source of food.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's slip in one more call before the break. This is Mo in Polk City. Hi, Mo.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, it's about my Brussels sprouts. I still have them in the ground. I've been harvesting them all along this summer. It's been a great year for them. As I'm harvesting them off the bottom, I see now that they are setting new fruit at the very base of the plant, right at the ground level. And it's got a really complex little dense form of root system on it. And I just wonder if those could be propagated. Can I overwinter those for next year's crop?
Well, I mean, I probably wouldn't. I don't know that you would gain much from all that work.
Okay.
That's the short of it.
You could do it.
You could do it. You could absolutely do it. But it's often best to kind of restart some of those things year after year. They get so big and woody and lanky and hard to deal with. It's really probably not worth the effort.
I see. And then also about leaving them until the frost, do you have any advice for me there? Can I still harvest them after the frost, or should I pull them out before?
Oh, no, absolutely. You keep them there as long as they're green. And Brussels sprouts and a lot of the close relatives tolerate light freezes very well. So you could have it easily well into November.
Especially with the weather the way we're going now, it doesn't look like we're going to have much of a freeze, at least here in central Iowa, till long after next week.
Oh, Linda, don't jinx us. All right.
Yes.
Mo, thank you so much for your call. We're going to take a short break. It's Horticulture Day. You can join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Linda Nave from Iowa State University Extension and Aaron Stile from Ryman Gardens in Ames. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we've been talking a lot about squash this hour and pumpkins and squash bugs, but you are welcome to join our conversation with any of your questions about the plants in your life or landscape. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we are going to return to the subject of squash bugs here. Sarah's on the line in Conrad. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I had the problem with squash bugs this summer, and I think that I had some success using diatomaceous earth, although I was a little late in applying it, so there were some heavy consequences. But I think that did reduce the population of squash bugs. Have you heard of anyone else having success with that?
No, actually we haven't.
Oh, okay. Well, I know it's been used with success on some other bugs, and I don't know if I was looking at it as wishful thinking that it reduced the population or if that actually did do some good.
Diatomaceous earth works on soft-bodied things where I'm not an entomologist, but what I understand, soft-bodied critters, such as slugs and snails, because they walk across it and in it, it causes them some discomfort and scratching because it's a very sharp and it pierces their skin and things like that. But I don't know. I've never heard it on squash bug, but that doesn't mean it might not work. But
okay.
I wouldn't invest all of my squash in that control method because at this point I would probably call it a little anecdotal. But I think it's worth kind of, you know, seeing what else might have played into it and really evaluating it.
Okay. Well, another year's coming up.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe call us next year, too, and let us know how it goes, Sarah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Dave is on the line in Anamosa. Hi, Dave.
Good morning.
Hi. What's your question?
I want to know about growing some pampas grass. My neighbor has some, and he said, come over and dig it up. And I want to know when and how and what's it take to get that stuff to grow really good.
Well, there are a lot of different ornamental grasses that people call pampas grass. The true pampas grass isn't winter hardy in Iowa. I suspect you have, is it growing in a ditch?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I suspect you have a miscanthus. There's a variety or a species of miscanthus that grows very well in wet conditions, gets a silvery flower on the top of it late in the season, and it can be very aggressive in the way that it spreads. So my only warning to you would be you could dig that up. I suppose you could do it in the fall. You probably have more success at this point in the spring. But be careful where you put it because it spreads very quickly by rhizome. So you'll want to make sure you have it in a place where you can contain it.
Well, or you don't care how much it
right,
spreads.
Or you don't care how big it gets, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to kind of fill up a ditch so mm-hmm. that it would make kind of like a dust barrier.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we're getting late enough in the season. I would probably advise you to wait until spring to dig and divide this plant. If this were September, I would have said go for it. But we're getting to a point now where it's going to be really hard for that plant to get established before winter hits.
Mm-hmm. So how far apart do I plant this stuff?
How soon do you want it to fill in?
Impossible.
Yeah. You know, then in that case, you know, a foot apart would fill in very quickly. If you don't have that much plant material or you're willing to wait a little bit longer, a little further apart would work too.
Okay. Well, thanks for the answer.
Yeah, Dave, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, we'll go to Gordon in Carroll. Hi, Gordon.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
How do I get rid of Virginia creeper? I've been fighting it for 40 years.
Virginia creeper, as in the vine that grows up the side of your house or on the fence?
It's in the garden and in the backyard, and I put Roundup on it. The leaves wither, but it doesn't kill the vine.
You know, I have known some people to have more success with a product that maybe contains, instead of glyphosate, triclopyr. Mm-hmm. It's often sold as poison ivy killer or as brush killer. Now would be a great time to apply it. What I would do is find the base of the plant, trim it off, and treat the stump. That way you're not spraying that chemical all over the place, and you have a little less issue, hopefully, with drift.
Okay.
But you can be pretty successful with some of these more woody kinds of weeds, treating them in the fall. Mm-hmm. So now would be a good time to try it. But look for something that has triclopyr in it, maybe as our next step.
Okay.
I don't know. Do you have any other?
No, that's a very good suggestion. You need to look at the label, root, the very fine print on the label, in the active ingredient part of that label for triclopyr.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Gordon, good luck. Thanks a lot for your call.
You're welcome.
Next up, let's go to Walt on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Walt.
Hello. The ongoing war with Creeping Charlie. I'm kind of worried. I've used the dicamba in the past, but I'm worried about my well getting polluted because I hear it has a pretty long life on its own, and it can trickle down or leach down into the groundwater.
What are the conditions like that this plant's growing in? I mean, is it really shady or anything like that?
Yeah, somewhat shady backyard, mm-hmm. basically. A couple walnut trees growing where it's mm-hmm. it seems to be flourishing nicely. Mm-hmm. Well's 118 foot deep, but I've read and I've used the dicamba on it two or three times over the last 5 years, but it doesn't seem to really have any long-lasting effect. It'll kill it back, and then, of course, it's very, very resistant to it, apparently, or very comes from somewhere else. You know, the creeping is the basic part of its name, obviously, because it does creep all over.
You might want to try a product that contains dicamba, but also contains other ingredients. Trimec, which contains mm-hmm. three different products, and apply it in the fall's a good time because they're aggressively growing and
sure.
moving the foods down into their root systems. So look for a Trimec that has a triple whammy.
Okay. Break down over time, or does it stay chemically active, and does it continue in the soil?
It's a foliar application, so you would apply it as a spray to the foliage, and mm-hmm. it depends on how much runoff you have. It's not going to get in the soil to any great extent.
Right, right.
Well, yeah, I know Roundup doesn't work on it, but Roundup does break down in, what, 7 days to a couple of weeks as far as the sunlight and everything, degrading the chemical aspect of it. But Trimec has the same breakdown ability? Or
that I do not know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, Walt, thanks a lot for your call. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And this is a question from Ralph and Carol. Can I keep one of the tubers from an ornamental sweet potato plant to use next year?
I've tried that. You know, you can do anything. That's the neat thing about gardening is we've had so many calls that says, can you do this? Well, yeah, you can do it. And it's fun. It's an experiment.
Yeah.
And it's something to kind of keep you excited about the garden season. Does it work very well? Not really.
No. You're probably better off actually taking stem tip cuttings, mm-hmm. rooting them over the winter, and then by the time spring comes, you can put them out again. The tuber gets
so
large.
Well, that sounds easy, too.
Tuber gets large, and I tried it just because I just wanted to see if I could do it, and I didn't. I wasn't successful.
Okay. All right. So, but, boy, taking stem cuttings, that sounds mm-hmm. like you need a lot of space. You need
a
greenhouse
not really.
For stuff like that.
No. The cuttings are only 2, maybe 3 inches long. You put them in a little 4-inch, 3-inch container.
After you root them in water, they root real easily.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's not a lot of light over the winter. The temperatures are lower, so it's not going to grow a whole lot in your house over the winter. And then it should be all set to go. Then you can put it out in spring, and mm-hmm. it'll take off.
If you can keep them away from the cats.
Yeah.
Oh, that's just my house. All right, just shut. All right, let's go back to the phones. Rita is on the line. Hello, Rita.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I just got a comment. My sister-in-law in central Minnesota was having trouble with potato bugs. And what she does now is she doesn't plant her potatoes until the 4th of July. And she doesn't get any potato bugs, and she still gets a full crop.
Hmm. Does she use them, like, as new potatoes?
No, I think she uses some, you know, regular full potatoes.
Okay.
Wow.
All right. Well,
I'm surprised that the growing season's long enough to get potatoes of a decent size.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it's because it's later in the season and it's warmer then that they grow voraciously.
I wonder what variety she plants then.
Yeah, I'd be interested
I
to know that, too.
I don't have any idea, but one way to avoid the potato bugs.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for your call.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Bye.
You can join our conversation. We still have time for a few more calls at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send your email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Dan is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Dan.
Hello there.
You've got another squash bug solution for us, huh?
Well, it works for me as squash bugs, I guess, behaviorally, they like shade, and especially in the hot summer or the hot spring. I just put a nice big leaf out there, usually taken from one of the squash plants, and the squash bugs like to go under there when it's hot. What's waiting for them is a little dust there on the ground, usually insecticidal. Mm-hmm. So instead of applying the insecticide to my plants, I just put it on that one little spot and it makes them a nice little squash hotel. They check in, but they don't check out.
Well, that's a good suggestion.
Yeah.
All right, Dan, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
And let's get back to some email questions here. This is from Phil in Davenport. Is it too late to sow grass seed or to put down sod in Davenport?
It's a little late to do that. Ideally, we would want that done by the end of September. You could maybe eke out the first part of October, especially in a year like this year, but that would really be pushing it, and you can't tell the future at the time. Mm-hmm. So it's probably too late this year.
All right. And, of course, I just had a big muddy patch in my yard that got torn up 2 days ago.
Well, you know,
well, you
one thing.
You can sow the seed.
You could do a dormant mm-hmm, seeding. Mm-hmm. So this one, you would wait until it gets cold enough that you know the seed won't germinate.
Right.
And then you can sow the seed and it will start to germinate as soon as the temperatures warm up enough in the spring. So you can get a little bit of head start by doing that. But even if I were dormant seeding, I might wait a little bit to do that.
Definitely.
Like after Thanksgiving.
Okay. Yeah. And here's a question from Kathy. My Brussels sprout plants are tall and full of leaves, but no sprouts. What should I do to get sprouts?
Well, it's a little late this year, mm-hmm. but I think it's a kind of a strange thing with Brussels sprouts. Sometimes they set on, sometimes they don't very well. They don't mature into a little sprout. that happens. And what causes that, I don't know. Just try it again next year. But right. This year was a pretty good year for Brussels sprouts, and so I'm surprised that she's having this problem.
And you mentioned harvesting Brussels sprouts after a frost. Does that change their flavor at all?
We're told it does. I haven't really noticed the difference, but some people really think it does.
I'm not a connoisseur enough of Brussels sprouts to know for sure mm-hmm. the
because
fine
it's
notes
supposed
that
to also
change.
Change the flavor of kale, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure it will because of the morphology of the plant and mm-hmm. and whatever, but technically I don't know.
Okay.
What goes on to cause that. But some people say it does change the flavor a little bit. Some say it improves it. Some don't like the flavor after frost.
A lot of people don't like the flavor of Brussels sprouts to start with. So
yeah.
They're not going to taste like candy after a frost, right?
Yeah. No. Talking about freeze, I said we're living on borrowed time right now with a freeze. We've had some spotty freezes around the state. But overall, Aaron and I were just saying some of our dahlias and cannas, our tender perennials, are still growing strong.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't hurt to dig them now if you have to cut them back and put them in storage, but wait until the first freeze and then go out and do this. So we're living on borrowed time right now for those of us who haven't had that killer freeze
right.
yet.
And it's a beautiful borrowed time. It's so lovely out
it?
There. All right, Sally's on the line next in Grimes. Hi, Sally.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I am wondering about planting a weeping willow. What kind of plant should I do? Should it be a bare root whip or a potted up plant? And can I do it yet this year?
You might have more success with woody plants later in the season than you would with perennials. I think we're starting to get late enough now that I would wait till spring to be most mm-hmm. successful. If you're not a real avid gardener, I would use a potted plant. Or if you're new to gardening, if you feel a bit more confident in your abilities, bare root would work well, especially mm-hmm. if you want to wait till spring.
It depends on availability, too.
Yeah.
Most of the time, you'll find them available in a containerized plant mm-hmm. rather than bare root. Unless you're ordering them online, they'll come bare root. So in which case, spring planting is excellent for that.
All right, Sally.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call. And we have another question in a similar vein. This is from Steve. Best to transplant a tree in the fall or the spring?
We get this question all the time. Both are okay. I think a lot of times folks consider the fall as like Thanksgiving, and that's a little late to be transplanting. Usually when a garden center says fall is for planting, they're talking about September and early October. Mm-hmm. So I personally like to plant in the spring. It gives the plant a lot of time to establish itself before the challenge of winter. But, I've had success in the fall, too. So, but when I say fall, I'm talking September, not November.
All right. So is there still a little window or not?
Oh, I have some stuff to still plant at my house, so I probably will be doing it, but it's not ideal.
But we're on borrowed time.
Yes,
right,
we are.
Right. Okay, the final squash bug question of the day. This is from John in DeSoto. Are some squash more resistant to squash bugs than others?
I do think some squash are less palatable to squash bugs
yes.
than others.
And it's a definite variety thing. We were talking earlier about trap crops because you plant a whole bunch of different varieties of squash, gourds, whatever. They will go to the one that they like the flavor of best.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, some are and some aren't. Yep.
All right. Well, Linda Nave, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Iowa State University Extension Program Specialist in the Value Added Agriculture Program, Linda Nave. Aaron Stile, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me today.
Aaron Stile, Manager of Public Programs at Ryman Gardens in Ames. And, of course, we'll be back with Horticulture Day again next Friday. Here with me in the studio is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Charity. In our first half hour, we'll talk with infectious disease specialist Dr. Michael Edmond of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He'll give us his reaction to our nation's flawed response to the Ebola outbreak. Also, how the hospital in Iowa City is preparing for the possibility of Ebola coming to Iowa. Also, Elwin Taylor will be along to talk about how much that heavy rain we had earlier in the week, delayed the crop harvest. And also, we'll ask him to give a long-range forecast. Maybe we'll find out what's going to happen this winter.
I've seen some pretty scary news reports lately about that.
We'll see if Elwin scares us, too.
All right. Ben, thanks a lot. River to River coming up today at noon on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa. Have a great weekend.